Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are kicking off our third week-long series on California's water crisis by focusing on solutions. This week, we'll be talking about water pricing, the best way to use recycled water, and our diets. By now, you've probably heard that it takes 1,600 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef, so what if we ate veggie burgers instead of hamburgers? Today, we are kicking off our series by talking about the most water-efficient cities around the globe. What have drought-stricken cities done to adopt cost-effective and environmentally sound policies to manage their water use? California officials are looking to cities in Australia, which suffered a torturous drought from the late 90s through 2012. So how did Australia's government and conservation advocates tackle their decade-long drought? What can we learn from drought-stricken areas around the globe to conserve water? And what would California need to do to make itself a model for water conservation? Today, we're joined by Brian Richter, a senior freshwater scientist at the Nature Conservancy and the lead author of the report Tapped Out, How Can Cities Secure Their Water Future? It compared the water supply histories of four cities, San Diego, Phoenix, San Antonio, and Adelaide, Australia. Brian is also author of Chasing Water, a guide for moving from scarcity to sustainability. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Rose.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Allison Lassiter, an urban and environmental planner and author of the forthcoming book, Sustainable Water, Challenges and Solutions from California. And Allison joins me in studio. Hi, Allison. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Connor Everts, co-facilitator at the Environmental Water Caucus. Their mission is to achieve comprehensive, sustainable water management solutions for all Californians. Connor is also executive director of the Southern California Watershed Alliance and co-chair of the DESAL Response Group, and he joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Connor. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Nice to be here.
Good morning. So, Connor, I want to start off with you because last time you were on our other water series about maybe a month and a half or 2 months ago, you said that you were really excited because so many people are talking about water issues, and you said that you feel like there's a revolution happening to democratize water. What's the update on that?
You know, I think it's moving forward, quite frankly. I think the politicians and the water agencies in particular are slow to catch on, and it's really overtaken them. And a good example is the Metropolitan Water District here that serves most of Southern California, about 17.2 million people. They had to backfill their water conservation and turf replacement program with $350 million. It was so successful they used it up in about 3 weeks. They're now stopping that program rather than continuing it. And they're going to get a lot of back cry from not only people, but progressive agencies like Santa Monica, where I live. Our new city manager already wrote a letter saying, why stop it when it's the best source of future water we have?
And so you're still in that excitement period? You think that things are really changing?
Well, I'd either be in the excitement period or the burned out period, because in 38 years of doing this, I've never seen this kind of response, not only from people like you that continue to do series on water because of the interest, but around the world, people are looking to California because we once were a leader in conservation. Back in the 90s, we used community-based organizations in L.A. to go out and be the delivery mechanism to really get down to a level of conservation we needed to. But we've really kind of lagged, and we've, you know, played off of that with increases of population. Our water demand remained flat. Now it's to go down 25% statewide. And at the same time, agencies now have less than a year to comply with legislation SB 7X7 in 2009, which requires an original 20% on top of that, that all the urban agencies have to do. So one way or another, we're going to get there. And once these things kind of take off, and the turf replacement is a good example, then they really get going. And having been to Australia on a water and energy tour myself, I've seen the future. And it doesn't look like what California looks like now. It looks like what Australia has already achieved.
Yeah, everybody's talking about Australia. Allison, you're actually going to move to Australia soon and to Melbourne. And so it'll be really interesting for you because you're coming out with this new book, Sustainable Water, Challenges and Solutions from California, to really be there to see what's happening on the ground in Australia.
Yes, I'm very excited about that. I'm headed towards Monash University to join a water-sensitive cities research team. So there they have economists, engineers, landscape architects, and planners all working together to envision this future water-sensitive city. It should be a great analog or at least a source of inspiration.
And so let's talk about Australia for a minute because it's getting a lot of attention. So Australia dealt with a horrendous drought from the late 90s through 2012. First off, how did that drought differ from what we're facing right now? Do you know, Allison?
You know, I'm still in the process of learning. I'm really new to the Australian context. I don't know if maybe one of the other folks.
I can mention what happened. It took almost 10 out of the 12 years for them to really blow up their water rights and realize that they were on the bleeding edge of climate change and to make the major changes. And at the same time, they had their priorities. They wanted to keep their rugby fields green. So given that, people would do almost anything. And then the price of water got so high because they invested heavily in ocean desalination, which wasn't really working. And after they went from drought to flood, they still have to pay for all those. Because then price became another factor and how you deal with this. And I'm glad you're going to Monash because then you're working with Andy Lipkus from Tree People here in L.A., who, because his wife's Australian, has been going there for years and bringing people from, including legislators and regulators from California to Australia. So we're definitely seeing kind of the ways that we're alike other places in the world and how they use a fraction of the water we do.
And Brian, you are the lead author of the report Tapped Out for the Nature Conservancy, which compared the water supply histories of four cities, including Adelaide, Australia. First off, for those of us who aren't really familiar with the drought in Australia, can you give us a little bit of context? How bad was it?
Yeah, I sure can. It was pretty horrendous. It was unlike anything they'd ever seen before. So that, in some ways, is similar to what California is going through presently. But they had about 60% less water available to them. So it presented some real challenges. And as your other guests have alluded to, they went through some pretty drastic water policy reforms in response to the drought, trying to make their way through the drought. In fact, a lot of these reforms got made right in the heart of the drought. So they were trying to adapt and change even while they were in the midst of suffering. And I think there's two important things maybe to bring out here that are relevant to California. One is that in large part because of the drought, the Australian cities now use less than half of the water that cities do in the western U.S., including California. So even our most water-conservative cities in the western U.S., Tucson, Arizona, San Antonio, San Diego, they get talked about a lot here in the United States, but those three cities are still using twice as much water as cities like Melbourne and Adelaide use on a per capita basis. So there's still a tremendous amount of room to go forward with water conservation in the urban environment, with the residential homes and businesses as well. The other key point was, and the bigger issue for much of Australia, was what was accomplished out in the agricultural sector. The reductions in water use there were quite severe, 40 to 50% reductions. And much of that was done in a way that involved a lot of water trading. So similar to California, the Australians permit their water use through a system of water rights, but they call them water entitlements there. And in the middle of the drought, they worked out a lot of new policy reforms that enabled farmers and cities to be able to exchange those water rights much more fluently. And it turned out that it lessened the pain of the economic damage and other challenges that they were going through by half, according to many estimates. So just being able to have some individuals or some companies or some cities be able to share water that they don't absolutely need with others that are in need of it through a financial exchange, through a negotiated exchange, proved to be very, very valuable in Australia.
So what can we learn when it comes to agriculture from Australia at a time when 80% of California's water goes to agriculture?
Well, there's certainly a lot more that farmers everywhere pretty much can do to be more efficient in their water use. There's a number of different ways to save water on the farm. using more efficient irrigation practices, going to a different crop type that may not require as much water, sometimes deciding to forgo growing a crop in certain years because it might be more profitable to the farmer to put the water right temporarily out on the water market and let somebody else use the water in that year rather than growing a crop in that year. So there's a lot of potential there, but again, having the ability to trade water, to exchange water, I think is the most important thing that I think California rightfully is looking at the water market system in Australia and trying to learn as quickly as you can from that, and there's an awful lot to be learned. They changed a lot of the rules that are presently inhibiting a lot of those kinds of exchanges from happening in California and the rest of the Western United States.
And Allison, you say that it's really important when we're talking about what we can learn from other cities to look at the makeup of these cities, the environmental structures, the population. In the case of Australia, for example, you point out that they have different water rights structures than we do.
That's true. Yes, all of these solutions are very contextual. So it's easy to look abroad and say, oh, they do it perfectly here or they do it perfectly there. But our history, our both environmental history and political history, sort of led us to this tangled mess that we're in now. And there is no silver bullet. One thing certainly that would help this whole situation is a more developed water market so that there's more incentive for farmers to become more efficient and then perhaps trade that water to its most economically beneficial use. This will also require a paired groundwater management that's more aggressive than we currently have. So we often forget that groundwater and surface water are connected hydrologically, and so if we can trade off surface water, we need to be able to monitor our groundwater and make sure that we're not just trading off surface water and then using groundwater. So this is a complex problem.
We did an entire show about groundwater and the historic legislation that was passed. What are your thoughts on the groundwater rules that will actually require now groundwater usage to be reported for the very first time in California's history?
This is very exciting and definitely a great direction to go in. There's still a long way to go. Right now, I believe most of the plans need to be implemented. It depends on whether you're in a critical basin or not by 2025. And at the rate we're using groundwater, this might be a little bit slow.
Right.
So I'm curious to see how the political momentum kind of continues in the next year. Right now, they're saying El Nino next year, maybe some rain. If it's dry again, maybe there'll be more aggressive moves towards groundwater conservation. I don't know.
And when it comes to urban conservation, for your forthcoming book, Sustainable Water, a number of people wrote chapters on challenges and solutions from California. What really stood out for you in terms of what we really need to learn when it comes to urban conservation?
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot more recently is just how we really need to slow down the flow of water through cities. And so this is stormwater, which we've really grasped onto pretty well, but then also municipal water. So all water that's entering cities, we kind of want to grab onto it and use it more intensively. So in the past, through the early 1900s and the mid-1900s, because of sanitation concerns and flood concerns, we just wanted to get the water out of the city as quickly as possible. Now we want to do things like infiltrate, recycle, reuse, and really get all we can out of the water before we let it go.
And Connor, how are California cities doing on that issue when it comes to water flowing through cities?
Well, it's an interesting issue because we don't integrate the different agencies. So we have three or four, sometimes five different agencies dealing with different aspects. What we've been pushing for in Los Angeles is to have one water agency, and we actually now have a process called One Water. So sanitation, Bureau of Sanitation, which we actually like working with, they actually do stormwater and they do the recycled water. The Department of Water and Power, who are more challenged because like many agencies, they sell water and are dependent on the revenue, so it's a commodity, they actually are doing the conservation and that doesn't always work out well. So we actually would like sanitation to be our only water agency, and a lot of other areas need to look at integrating the thousands and thousands of separate water agencies, often when they're water districts with individual elected board members and often conflicting fiefdoms, maybe across the street from each other. And we have to have a way of integrating that. And until, as was said, we really deal with groundwater. And I was manager or president of a groundwater agency, the board of an agency in the little town of Ojai. The current legislation, is, as much as it's a historic first step, doesn't have to be fully implemented until 2040. At the rate we're going of 13 trillion gallons overdraft and the slow response we're getting on this, it's a nice pat on the back, but we have to get far more aggressive with groundwater. And I hope El Nino doesn't distract us from facing these realities.
Right. Yeah.
And marketing is a good way of looking at this, but there are also impacts on what we call third-party impacts, environmental justice impacts, on those on the other end. So it shouldn't just be those with these arcane pre-1914 rights that have the right to sell. While there may be small farmers who are struggling or farm workers are going to be impacted and not look at all of those impacts as well.
That is Connor Everts. He's co-facilitator at the Environmental Water Caucus. Their mission is to achieve sustainable water management solutions for all Californians. He's also executive director of the Southern California Watershed Alliance and co-chair of the DESAL Response Group. We're also joined by Dr. Allison Lassiter, an urban and environmental planner and editor of the forthcoming book, Sustainable Water, Challenges and Solutions from California. Brian Richter is a senior freshwater scientist at the Nature Conservancy and lead author of the report Tapped Out, How Can Cities Secure Their Water Future? It looked at the water supply histories of four cities, San Diego, Phoenix, San Antonio, and Adelaide, Australia. Brian is also author of Chasing Water, A Guide for Moving from Scarcity to Sustainability. Today on Your Call, we are kicking off our third week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about solutions. Today, we are kicking off our series by talking about the most water-efficient cities around the globe. What can we learn from other cities? If you've lived in a place that implemented really great conservation conservation policies, we'd love to hear from you. What really stood out for you? What is different about where you live now and, say, the place that you used to live, whether it's in the United States or outside of the country? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And now that the drought is getting international attention, is there anything else you've learned when you've been reading about, say, what they're facing in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or Australia? What really has stood out for you? And if you have any questions about urban water conservation and what we can learn from other places, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Brian, since your Tapped Out report looked at San Diego, Phoenix, San Antonio, and Adelaide, Australia, what really strikes you when it comes to urban conservation and what we can learn?
Well, I think some of the most important things that we see across all of those cities is that a large portion of water use in the city goes to watering outdoor landscaping. So residential lawns, commercial landscaped areas, golf courses, that sort of thing. In many cities that are in drier regions, such as California, the Western United States, Australia, half or more of the total water use in the city is going to that outdoor watering. And so if you're looking for places to conserve water use in the urban environment, that's always one of the most important places to look. And so there's a lot of good programs that are being talked about in California with turf replacement, not just talked about, but also being implemented, replacing green lawns with less water-intensive vegetation and moving toward more native species and that sort of thing. That's really, really important step forward. But there are other ways, of course, to conserve water inside the home as well. When some of the studies looked at Australian cities versus cities in the Western U.S., beyond the outdoor watering, the next place was in toilets. The Australians had been on the two-button flush toilet system for a long time now, and finally, U.S. manufacturers are starting to move toward those types of toilets as well. It makes a difference.
Your report found that Adelaide in Australia reduced its water use by 25% since 2003 by implementing water conservation measures. And these water savings were largely achieved by reducing landscape watering around homes and businesses. And so has that been consistent since 2003? Is that like government policy?
I think it's as much as anything, it's just simply that those cities are are right up against the limits of what water supply is available to them. And so, similar to California, there's just not a lot of surplus water. And Australia, by the way, gets the flip side of the El Nino. So if California gets a break with El Nino this year, the Australians are going to get the downside of that, which is a return to very, very dry conditions. And so the Australian cities did relax a little bit. We saw a little bit of a bump up in the per capita water use rates following the drought, which largely came to an end about 2009. We did see a little bit of a bump up as people went back to some old practices. But for the most part, what we see is that once residents learn how to be more conservative with their water, they tend to stick with that. They tend to practice those behaviors as sort of a regular lifestyle decision from that point on. So I think that there's a lot of potential there. I think we can get a lot more efficient with the plumbing fixtures in our house, whether it's washing machines or dishwashers or toilets or showers, but also outside, across all of the cities that we've been looking at, the outside water, landscape watering is the first place to look for water savings.
And Connor, what do the trends tell us about California citizens? Because on April 1st, Governor Jerry Brown issued an emergency executive order asking residents to cut back at least 25% of their water use. And the State Water Resources Control Board just announced that in May, residents cut water consumption by an average of 29%. So on average, do you think California citizens are doing a pretty decent job?
I think we're getting there. I think we have to be honest with the numbers, and that is that they don't correct for weather. So when we have a cool month, which we did in May, and then we had a previously hot April, it's hard to compare for that. And we're really taking a one-year window as a baseline from 2013 to 2014. Nevertheless, I think the tsunami of response is happening. I think the water agencies, I know you're going to talk about this later in the week, are going to have to deal with pricing
right.
and how to deal with the loss of revenue and maintaining their conservation programs because they need to do that. And when we talked about conservation, we actually call it efficiency or demand side. We're not just talking about using less water through appliances and outdoor, which can be as much as 70% in a lot of inland areas in California. We're also talking about using gray water, so everything but your toilet and kitchen sink water, and that's a revolution that's just starting to take off, and there's groups like Gray Water Gorillas and the Gray Water Corps and others. We're talking about capturing rainwater like they did very effectively in Australia, where they call them tanks. We're talking about taking a broader look at what they call a catchment or what we call a watershed, and that watershed can be as big as where your water is imported from to your local watershed to your backyard. And how do you take a system-wide view of that? We're also talking about using recycled water. Israel uses about 80% of their wastewater recycled to the point where it can be used for irrigation and other usages. Orange County has been doing about 30%. It's just expanded to 100,000 acre feet or a third of a million gallons as an acre foot, the way we talk about supply. LA is still only doing 1% or 2%. We have a lot of public perception issues. I think we're past. But we need to move forward with those agencies that are still treating, embedding energy in water, and then dumping it in the ocean. So there are a lot of, and we're going to see more stormwater projects, as was mentioned earlier, which are larger scale projects. So when it does rain, even during the drought, we've had these heavy rains in December and in February, and they come all at once, and then this long time of dry in between. We need to do everything we can to capture and put it back in the ground. So the city of Santa Monica's library has 210,000 gallons underneath the new main library to capture and reuse, including on toilets. And Tree People, the environmental organization, has about 200,000 gallons also underneath their parking lot. And with
Connor,
their landscaping, that's enough for the whole year for them. That's
all
they need.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the most water-efficient cities around the globe and what we can learn from them. We'll be back after this.
Lots of different ways to join in today's conversation on the phone or by email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free phone number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or again, the email address, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Stay tuned. This is 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our third week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about how water prices are set in California. Two-thirds of water districts use some form of tiered water pricing to encourage conservation, but conservation measures often lead to higher rates. And then there's no single price that California farmers pay. So how should water pricing change? That is tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about the best way to use recycled water. Thursday, we'll talk about our diets. Governor Jerry Brown recently said we should all eat veggie burgers. It was just a sentence that he kind of just mentioned it in a talk he gave in Los Angeles. He didn't really elaborate on it. We wish he did, but we'll be talking about that on Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are kicking off our series by talking about the most water-efficient cities around the globe. If you've lived in a different city, whether it's in the U.S. or outside of the U.S., and you thought, wow, why don't we do that here in Northern California? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you've read about water-efficient cities in the media, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on just different things, inventive ways to conserve water at the urban level? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Brian Richter, Senior Freshwater Scientist at the Nature Conservancy, lead author of the report Tapped Out. It looked at the water supply histories of four cities, San Diego, Phoenix, San Antonio, and Adelaide, Australia. Brian is author of Chasing Water, a guide for moving from scarcity to sustainability. Dr. Allison Lassiter is an urban and environmental planner and editor of the forthcoming book, Sustainable Water, Challenges and Solutions from California. And Connor Everts is co-facilitator at the Environmental Water Caucus. He's executive director of the Southern California Watershed Alliance and co-chair of the DESAL Response Group. And we were talking just about so many different ways to conserve water at the urban level and also at the individual level. And Allison, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the fact that California residents have cut water consumption by an average of 29%. And I noticed that when we started our series, there really wasn't any, you know, there were some signs, like Yosemite has signs on water conservation. I was driving from Tahoe back to the Bay Area last weekend, and now those highway signs that usually give out amber alerts say conserve water. And just over the last week, I've noticed that more restaurants are talking about it, businesses are talking about it. So what are your thoughts about just, you know, raising awareness versus government policies and what it takes to really change habits?
Right. So it's very exciting that it's becoming a statewide conversation. So much of our water use is actually just trends and what we're used to. One of the things that's pretty amazing to me, we've discussed this already, is how we use 30 to 80% of, depending on where you're located in the state, we use 30 to 80% of water outside. So this is typically to maintain turf grass, but it's also to maintain like sort of intensive vegetable gardens. And this, the turf grass in particular, is an English garden style that we have taken upon ourselves and sort of created as a national phenomenon. And everyone is really into their turf grass. But it's just a trend that we've sort of picked up for the last 150 years, and it doesn't need to be the next 150 years. And so it's exciting to see people adapting more native vegetation and moving towards a more like California-specific landscape style. So I'm hoping that that will work. I think that it is more effective for people to choose to do this on their own rather than it to be regulated. It's a very challenging thing to regulate. What would be nice, though, is for there to be steeper water prices so that if somebody chooses to maintain a turf grass lawn, they're actually they're paying for it. So you can have that within some reason, maybe. I think people are still working out the pricing and the allocation, but you would have to really pay for it.
Because I'm noticing that some people are, and complexes, are leaving their grass brown and yellow, but some are very green still.
Right. I would like to see the ones that go brown and yellow actually change their vegetation styles, because the sort of brown and yellow says we're surrendering to this drought and this is going to be an ugly thing and we wish we could have turf grass. I would love to see us just kind of shift our ethos towards different landscape styles that can be really beautiful.
Do you think that we are shifting our thinking about these styles because of water scarcity and population growth?
I think so. I think it's gradually happening. You know, there's some research that shows that when one person changes their landscaping in an area, then there's this sort of trickle effect that happens around the whole neighborhood where people adapt more water-sensitive styles. So this you can kind of think of it as like an urban acupuncture where you change one lot and then there's this ripple effect.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, we're talking today about what we can learn from other cities, but what can we learn from each other? If you've seen that kind of ripple effect where you live, and really it is about just raising awareness, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Lynn in San Francisco. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I was planning actually to go to the Board of Supervisors this week to discuss water issues, so it was really cool to hear this topic on the radio.
Oh, great.
And I was at the main library. They had some kids there from the museum out in Golden Gate Park asking people what they thought could be some ways that we could maintain water, and it kind of inspired me to come up with some ideas. And one of the ideas I had wanted to put past the Board of Supervisors is some new, like, things we could vote on in terms of changing some of our apparatuses on our sinks and things, or to come up with some ideas to manage our faucets differently. For instance, I notice when I brush my teeth and I turn the water on, I use a whole bunch of water just to wet my toothbrush. And I was thinking that on the faucets there could be adjustments for, like, brushing your teeth, washing your face, so that the amount of water that comes out of the nozzle changes based on what your use is. Because we lose a lot of water through the drain. I also wanted to put past the Board, we're opening up a lot of the streets for new water pipes. And I was thinking that in certain neighborhoods or in people's backyards or even next to their sink, we could have small, either a large tank or small tanks, depending on what the housing situations are, whether people have backyards or not. And the water that goes through the sink or through the bathtub could be rerouted into our toilets, because the toilets take up so much water when we flush them. There could be a pipe, all of our gray water could go into one tank, and then all that water from the tank, instead of being cleaned through the water company and then being put back in the ocean, could actually be recycled back into our toilets.
Well, Lynn, thank you for all of those ideas. And we have a bunch of callers on the line with ideas, and so we'll take those and then we'll get responses from our guests. Thank you for calling in, and I hope the meeting with the Board goes well. Let's go next to Ed in Richmond. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I love Lynn's idea about using the gray water to the feed system for toilets. I have a similar idea. I live alone, and when this water thing whole water thing got going, I thought of an idea, and I've actually done a radical thing, which Lisa was suggesting. Radical thing is I use the water bottles, at least I've tried using the water bottles, that you drive by juice in. I've got to slow down. By juice in, like cranberry juice or cran raspberry or something like that. Now, at least a guy can actually just simply urinate into the bottle. You collect it. When it's full, you just set it aside. You get a bunch of them, you know, like 10 or 15 of them. And then you just sit down and pour them one by one into the toilet. Then you flush the toilet once. That saves at least 10 or 15 gallons a month. And then the second thing, you know, there's really, urine is sterile. So there's really no reason if a person uses a toilet and just urinates, you can just close the lid, you know, politeness, you know. And then next time you come, lift the lid, urinate again. And when it's time to do number two, you just flush the whole thing. And that saves a lot of water, too.
All right. Well, thank you for those ideas. We have a couple of emails. Marie Louise says, would you address the fact that while I am conserving water diligently, Nestle and others are still permitted to use California's water and bottle it for profit and continue trashing the planet with plastic bottles, and the recent approval of fracking by the governor and the impact that these two issues have on the current situation. And Marie Louise, we did a whole show on bottled water, the bottled water industry. We've also done a bunch of shows on fracking. So thanks for that. I mean, this is interesting, though. Allison, maybe you can speak to this, because people feel like, you know, I'm doing my part. I'm taking shorter showers. I'm turning off the valve while I soap up. I mean, people are doing amazing things. They're putting buckets in their showers while they're showering and then using that water to, you know, water their plants. Okay, they're doing this, but then you hear about Nestle, you know, bottling the water, fracking in California, the state actually doing things that use so much water, or at least the state approving measures that they allow companies to use so much water. What are your thoughts on that?
This is really tough, because a lot of water conservation now requires sort of just an ethical choice, and there needs to be some more structure in place that really creates incentives towards conservation, like real economic incentives. So this gets back to our previous discussion on regulating groundwater and then pricing and water rights. So this is a deep problem that I hope we'll be able to fix in the coming years.
And Brian, you looked again at San Diego, Phoenix, San Antonio, and Adelaide, Australia. Have these cities implemented policies that, you know, either force citizens to take action or maybe tackle the bottled water issue or the fracking issue?
Well, first, you know, for the most part, some of the most successful cities are not places where they have told people what to do, but they've provided incentives that encourage them to do the right thing. I think that's really important. It's just a note on human nature, I think, that we can oftentimes be reluctant or resistant to something when we're told to do it. But if there's a little bit of an enticement, a little bit of an incentive, then we can do pretty remarkable things. And so, for instance, with the turf grass replacement and the fact that a city might provide $1, $2, $3 per square foot of grass to be replaced with some other less water-intensive vegetation is an example of the kind of incentive that actually has proven to be very, very successful in many of those cities. The other point that's been brought up a couple times is on the pricing. And consumers do respond quite markedly to changes in price, including their water bills. And so what we see is that as the water bill increases go up, or more particularly as if you use larger and larger volumes of water, that you move into different price categories, those have been very, very successful. And Connor and Allison both mentioned this earlier, too. On the fracking and bottled water, I think there's a couple different ways to look at those issues. And one of them is, if you look at it volumetrically, in terms of how much total water those industries are using as compared to all the rest of the water use, they are oftentimes diminishingly small volumes on a relative scale. That doesn't mean they're inconsequential in terms of volume, but in most places, it's only a small fraction of the total water that's being used. And so it might be, if we're looking for ways to conserve water, that there's other areas like irrigated agriculture where we might get more bang for the buck. Hmm. The interesting thing about bottled water and fracking is the spin-off or knock-on impacts to the environment. So if we have leakage from fracking wells that gets into potable drinking water supplies, you know, into aquifers that we're using for other purposes, that's a horrible thing. And that's something that we need to be very careful about and regulate against to the extent possible. With bottled water, an example of the knock-on effect that Allison mentioned is the fact that we're creating so much plastic, and the plastic has to be disposed of properly or properly recycled. So there's, when looking at these issues, it's we have to be careful not to look at any one issue in isolation, but rather in a more holistic sense. What all is involved in the extraction of water, in the use of water, in the equipment or the other things, you know, that are involved in the particular use of water.
And that is Brian Richter, Senior Freshwater Scientist at the Nature Conservancy. Dr. Allison Lassiter is an urban and environmental planner, and Connor Everts is co-facilitator at the Environmental Water Caucus. Today we are kicking off our third week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about the most water-efficient cities around the globe and what we can learn from them. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Jessica in San Francisco. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had two comments or suggestions. The first is how much water we waste when the tap's running, trying to get it warm. Some people have the instant hot water. I'm not sure what the energy use for that is, but it's safe water. And then the second is you can replace your concrete if you have backyards or driveways. You can replace concrete with rock gardens or other things that allow rainwater to drain back into the ground as opposed to running off into our sewage.
Great. Thank you for those. Let's go next to Murray in San Francisco. Hi, Murray.
Yes. If anybody knows about the California Water Atlas, it reminds me a little of the movie Chinatown, because most of the water is being used by big agribusiness and huge companies that utilize tons of water. But eventually it's going to come down to sort of a reverse aqueduct system from the ocean running into the lowest place in the world called Death Valley, where they have super high temperatures. And that combined with solar-powered desalinization will give you drinking water and electricity as a byproduct. What do you think of that?
All right, thank you. Do you want to take that one, Allison?
Oh, that's a complicated one.
I'd love to take that one.
Oh, okay, please. Connor.
So, you know, the idea that there's a silver bullet to save us from ourselves, desalination, ocean desalination, gets a lot of that interest. It does make sense on the wellhead to do brackish desalination because the energy is less. But the amount of solar energy it would take to do even a small plant in Cambria, which we looked at, was about 7 acres of property. So while it sounds like a good engineering solution, we aren't looking for that as a it would take one every 2 or 3 miles along the Southern California coast to get any appreciable amount of water. We will be industrializing the coast and killing fish with the intakes, and we'll only create another set of problems. The big gap here, kind of the missing link that we don't talk about, is there's over 1 million people without access to clean, safe, and affordable water before the drought, and they really should be a priority. And when we get into pricing, we want to make sure that the very lowest level conservation is perhaps free or at a very affordable level, like a lifeline rate like we have on electricity. So those that really do save and can't afford to do more, which are usually the people who do the most, aren't being penalized in any way. And the other element is we're not returning this water to the environment that we save. And if you ask people, do you want this water to go for new development or new almonds? As someone mentioned, industrial agriculture that you can see being planted even during the drought off the five right now. Or do you want this water to go back in the environment as it did in Mono Lake, where 30% of what we save, what the community group saved, goes back to the environment? We shouldn't miss that opportunity to realize the environment's taking a hard hit. And there's a bill out by the House that came out last week that would like to take away all the environmental protections. So we have to look at the cumulative impacts of everything we're doing, not put it all on the urban users, because they'll come up with innovative ideas, as we have heard.
Right, and we're being inundated with emails from people who are doing all kinds of things. I mean, really going to great lengths to conserve water. And I'm glad you brought that up, Connor, because on Thursday we're going to talk about agriculture. And, you know, what if people did eat less meat, for example? Then what does that mean? I mean, in a globalized food system, what does that mean? And then how would that water be redistributed? That's the other question. Also, you mentioned people who don't have access to clean water. I mean, there are some towns that don't have water at all right now in California. East Porterville is starting to get more media attention.
But that's kind of interesting, too, because in Porterville itself is a nice green public golf course. And that there are wells being drilled for almonds, which are mostly exported, underneath the residential users. So there's a class issue that happens here, too, and those that can afford to drill and pay for the electricity, and there's an energy and water nexus that has to be looked at, are impacting those that don't have a voice. And that really has to be looked at. We also have pollution all along the 99 in little towns and in southeast L.A. here, a town called Maywood, where people who are only reliant on polluted groundwater are in real trouble, while beautiful, clear water snowmelt when we have it. And I was actually in flash floods in the eastern Sierra. They closed Tioga last weekend. So if anyone has any doubt about the kind of weird weather we're getting with climate change, it's happening and it's impacting us. But at the same time, those that really need the water and the financial support should be getting it, and they should have given it to them in the landscape and turf repair, because a lot of those people let their gardens go brown doing the right thing, and then they couldn't get the incentive because you had to show a nice picture of a green lawn before you could get the incentive. And quite frankly, those lawns are just dormant. As soon as we get a freak summer monsoonal rain, they come back green again. So we have to do the right thing with landscape, and we have to provide jobs and economic opportunity to do that.
All right, we have an email from Fred who says, my city of Pacific Grove required me to install a 0.8 gallon per flush toilet when I was doing work on the house. I griped initially, but to my surprise, these toilets work more reliably and clog less than any toilet I've ever had. It's a very quick way to save a lot of water. Thanks for the great show. Thank you for the email, Fred. And Joe says, I use all the water from my kitchen and bathroom sinks, both for flushing the toilet and for outside watering. It allows me to have a vegetable garden that I would otherwise feel was not justifiable. I only use gray water, safe soap, and transfer from the bin in the sink to the buckets outside. It works, and it's a lot of water. GS says, if you shower every day, you could shower every other day or even every third day. Showering every day saves 50% versus a daily shower, or take a very short shower. Thank you for that email, GS. And let's go to Samantha in Oakland. Hi, Samantha. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I really appreciated everything that's been said so far. I agree with what Brian said earlier, that it's not one issue. I just wanted to touch really quickly. I know you said you're going to talk about it next week or on Thursday, but the naughty meat thing, I've been doing that since September, and I feel like I've saved a lot of water by not doing that. The agriculture and meat industry uses a lot of water, not only just to give the animals drinking water, but they have to grow crops for them to eat as well. And it's just so much water being wasted that the only solution I found, do not only in addition to trying to conserve water around the house, but is to stop eating meat. And I feel like I'm drinking water and I feel healthier for it. So I think that's a great solution.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Samantha. Allison, you want to take that one?
Sure. I'm excited you're not eating meat. I've been a vegetarian myself for a long time. One of the things, though, I think we need to be really careful about doing is demonizing others. So there's a lot of people like to point to like some other industry or some other household as being the ones that's using all the water. And right now, we actually can't really facilitate agricultural to urban water transfers very well in California. So even if ag used far less water, that wouldn't mean that we would somehow have more water for cities. And even if we did, what would we use it for? More grass lawns? So there's also this illusion that, like, there's sort of one product that is water in California. Actually, we have all of these different kinds of water that are different qualities and come with different timing. So some of the water we use in agriculture is a lower quality water, and it's not as reliable of a water. So in urban areas, we need perfectly clean water all the time. And that's kind of a hard feat. So this is, like, one of the complexities of the discussion with agriculture, and we just want to I don't want to be too hard on ag, I guess, in some respects.
Well, and we're going to talk about those issues on Thursday's show. Brian, you mentioned ag in Adelaide, Australia. Did you learn anything else about agriculture in, say, Phoenix or San Antonio?
Well, primarily the case that we were trying to make in the paper was that, first and foremost, that water conservation, water efficiency is always the smartest investment in terms of trying to resolve a water problem or trying to resolve a water shortage. So the gallon of water that you don't need, that you don't use, is always the cheapest gallon of water. And the reason that all these other forms of water supply are more expensive is largely because of the electricity that it takes to get the water to you. So if you're desalinating ocean water, it takes a tremendous amount of electricity, a tremendous amount of energy, and it's very, very expensive to take the salt out of the water. If you're importing water from far distant rivers, the Colorado River, or from a long distance away, it takes a lot of energy to move that water uphill and over long distances to get it to you. So the electricity, the energy, water intersection that's been alluded to here is a really, really important one. The other point I want to make on agriculture here, because we're talking a lot about beef and vegetarianism and that sort of thing, the public is becoming much more attuned to how much water it takes to produce the things that they consume in their everyday life, and including their diet. And so we know that a vegetarian diet requires about a third of the water that a diet that's more heavy in meat would require to supply on average. But I always encourage everybody to go the next step further, which is not all water use is the same, and to pay attention to where those crops are being grown. And I think this is a really important issue, and I hope that you'll discuss it on Thursday with some of your folks talking about agriculture. The big question is, Where should we be growing these crops? Mm-hmm. Where should we be producing beef if we're producing beef, or the feed for beef that requires so much water?
Right.
So, for example, here in the East in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live now, I do eat beef occasionally, but I'm very careful about selecting beef that I know has been grown on the grass that grows in abundance out here on rainwater alone. And it doesn't require any supplemental irrigation, which means we don't have to take water out of the rivers, out of the aquifers, in order to grow the grass that grows the beef. And so being tuned into where the products that you're consuming, whether it's food or other products in your daily lives, where that comes from and what the water situation is in those places, to the extent that you can figure that out, is a really important part of this water responsibility, water sustainability question.
And we'll definitely talk about that on Thursday's show. And so thanks for bringing up those issues. We've got about a minute left. Allison, final thoughts from you. I mean, what are you, when you're about to move to Melbourne, Australia, what are you looking forward to learning about to share with people back in California?
Well, one of the things that's really interesting that they've been working on is they've reduced their water load so much that now people are saying, well, how much is enough? Like, when can we stop conserving? And one of the things they've done is reduce the vegetation in the city because they haven't wanted to water it. And now they're seeing some energy impacts of having reduced trees around. So there's some thoughts mm-hmm. about, like, maybe we do need to have, like, what's our relationship with water supposed to look like? What can it, how much is good enough? And, like, how can that fluctuate seasonally?
Interesting. We'd love to have you on maybe from Australia when you're there. And Connor, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds.
I would say the Quiet Blue Revolution is happening, and the response you've got from people shows that. I think the agencies have to maintain and continue these incentives because the public wants them and they're using them, and we need to change. But the change has to come to all sectors in California, and those others are going to step up when we realize that water is a finite resource.
Connor Everts is co-facilitator at the Environmental Water Caucus. Dr. Allison Lassiter is an environmental planner and editor of the forthcoming book, Sustainable Water, Challenges and Solutions from California. Brian Richter is senior freshwater scientist at the Nature Conservancy and author of the book, Chasing Water, A Guide for Moving from Scarcity to Sustainability. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rose.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How are water prices set in California? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our week-long series on solutions to the water crisis by discussing the price of water. Two-thirds of water districts use some form of tiered water pricing to encourage conservation, but measures have led to higher rates. And there's no single price that California farmers pay. So how should water pricing change? And what if farmers had to buy water on the open market? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.